podcasttoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Conservative MPs are increasingly worried about British Prime Minister Boris Johnson's competence and drive after he gave a rambling speech to business leaders and was accused of losing his grip over a series of key policies from social care to rail. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Aubrey Allegretti, Rowena Mason, Joanna Partridge and Rob Davis. The piece is titled Johnson Losing the Confidence of Tory Party After Rambling CBI Speech. Conservative MPs are increasingly worried about British Prime Minister Boris Johnson's competence and drive after he gave a rambling speech to business leaders and was accused of losing his grip over a series of key policies from social care to rail. Senior members of his own Conservative Party said they needed Boris Johnson to get the government back on track after a disastrous two-week period amid dismay about his performance at the Confederation of British Industry CBI conference, where he lost his place in his speech for about 20 seconds and diverted into a lengthy tangent about Peppa Pig. The Prime Minister was also facing a substantial rebellion over his social care proposals. Anger at the decision to scale back rail improvements for the north of England and frustration over the government's failure to keep its promises on small boats crossing the channel. It caps a difficult fortnight for the Prime Minister after he admitted he crashed the car into a ditch in his handling of the Owen Paterson lobbying scandal. Nervousness among Tory MPs about No. 10 Downing Street intensified after one Downing Street source told the BBC there was a lot of concern inside the building about the Prime Minister. It's just not working, adding that the cabinet needs to wake up and demand serious changes, otherwise it'll keep getting worse. A former cabinet minister also told The Guardian that there was an accumulation of things building up, really relating to his competence, and that is beginning to look very shaky after a pretty bad fortnight. He said it was unlikely to result in a leadership challenge while opinion polls were still fairly even between the Tories and Labour, but it could be problematic for Boris Johnson if that changes when an election is looming. Another senior backbencher said Boris Johnson's CBI speech had been a mess, while a third Tory MP said, "I thought today's performance was the most embarrassing by a Conservative Prime Minister since last week's Prime Minister's questions. Someone needs to get a grip. He's losing the confidence of the party." Another Conservative MP referenced the process by which MPs can submit letters of no confidence to the chair of the 1922 committee, Graham Brady, saying, "It might not only be Father Christmas postbag filling up towards the end of the year. Sir Graham Brady could find he needs a bigger one too." The Prime Minister's speech on Monday, 22nd of November, met a frosty reception among business leaders over its lack of substantial policy. In a sprawling address, Boris Johnson lost his place and spent 20 seconds uttering "Forgive me" three times as he shuffled the printed pages on his podium. He then revealed he had spent Sunday on a trip to Hampshire's Peppa Pig World, an amusement park dedicated to a children's cartoon character, using it for a series of digs at the BBC and at civil servants. He said the TV show, worth £6 billion, was rejected by the BBC and has now been exported to 180 countries. He added, "I think this is pure genius, don't you? No government in the world, no Whitehall civil servant, would conceivably have come up with Peppa Pig." Boris Johnson also imitated the sound of an accelerating car with grunts that the official Downing Street release transcribed as "room room." And another point, he compared himself to Prophet Moses over his plan to help business invest in tackling climate change. The Prime Minister said, "I said to my official the new Ten Commandments were that thou shalt develop industries like offshore wind, hydrogen, nuclear power, and carbon capture." After the speech, business leaders questioned the Prime Minister's focus. Mike Cherry, the national chair at the Federation of Small Businesses, said, "Last week's HS2 announcement has left a lot of small business owners wondering if the government is already losing its way, not just in speeches, but with regards to levelling up in the round." After the speech, Boris Johnson was asked if he was okay by a journalist. The Prime Minister defended his performance at the CBI, saying, "I think that people got the vast majority of the points I wanted to make, and I thought it went over well." Monday evening, 22nd of November, around a dozen Conservative MPs from the 2019 intake glumly gathered in one of their parliamentary offices. They were said to be disappointed and disillusioned and shared discontent that Boris Johnson wasn't listening to feedback. Like business leaders, the main concern of Conservative politicians was Boris Johnson's failure to live up to expectations on policies such as levelling up, rail and social care. Up to 20 Conservative MPs were expected to rebel on changes to the social care cap on Monday night. Shortly after Boris Johnson's speech, the Labour Party leader Keir Starmer set out to business leaders what he called Labour's pro-business agenda, including closer trade and regulatory ties with the European Union. Keir Starmer said, "I think that sometimes, if I may say so, our party has come across as thinking that business is to be tolerated in some way, but not to be celebrated as a good in itself." The Labour leader told another gathering of the CBI's multi-venue conference, this one in Birmingham, he said, "That mindset has changed under my leadership."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The unity of Muslims is a definite Quranic duty. This is a part of a speech delivered on October 24, 2021 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic and foreign participants in the 35th International Islamic Unity Conference.
The unity and solidarity of Muslims is not a tactic in the way as some people now think that we should be united because of certain circumstances. No, it is a matter of principle. The cooperation of Muslims is necessary. If Muslims are united, they will help each other and all will become strong. When this cooperation exists, even those who want to interact with non-Muslims, which is all right, will enter into this interaction with full hands. So the next point is that this is a fundamental matter, not a tactical one. The reason we in the Islamic Republic greatly emphasize the unity of Muslims is that there is a wide gap. Today, there is a constant, serious, premeditated effort to create differences between Muslim denominations and between Shia and Sunni. Today, the words Shia and Sunni have entered the American political discourse.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
What do Americans have to do with Shia and Sunni? For several years now, in American political discourse, the issue of being a Sunni or being a Shia has been introduced. They identify some countries as Shia countries and some as Sunni countries. Despite the fact that they are against the essence of Islam and hostile towards it, they do not abandon the issue of Shia and Sunni. So, such issues exist. They are aggravating the discourse on a daily basis and increasing the misunderstandings. Therefore, we emphasize unity, and this is the reason. As you can see, the puppets installed by the US create discord in the world of Islam wherever they can. The closest example is the tragic, upsetting events in Afghanistan these last two Fridays, where they blew up a Muslim mosque while the people were praying.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you. A jury in Virginia decided on Tuesday, 23rd of November, that the who's who of U.S. white supremacist leaders and hate groups should pay more than $25 million in damages to plaintiffs who said they suffered physical or emotional injuries during the deadly Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia in 2017. The article you're about to hear has been written by USA Today journalists Will Carlos and Kevin McCoy, with a contribution from the Associated Press. The piece is titled, Jury Awards Plaintiffs $25 million in Lawsuit Against White Supremacists Behind Violence in Charlottesville Unite the Right Rally. Virginia decided on Tuesday, 23rd of November, that a who's who of U.S. white supremacist leaders and hate groups should pay more than $25 million in damages to plaintiffs who said they suffered physical and emotional injuries during the deadly Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia in 2017. Though the jury found the defendants liable under a Virginia conspiracy law, the seven white and four black jurors were unable to reach a verdict on whether the defendants were liable under a federal statute that outlaws conspiracies to commit racially motivated violence. Coming after a third day of deliberations, the decision showed the jurors rejected defense arguments that the trial represented a referendum on free speech rights. The jurors imposed $500,000 each in punitive damages against several defendants and $1 million each against several organizations under state conspiracy claim. They limited compensatory damages on that claim to no more than $1 each. The jury found that lawyers for the plaintiffs proved a claim of racial or religious violence under Virginia law. The panel awarded two plaintiffs $250,000 each in compensatory damages and $200 each in punitive damages to be paid by several defendants. The jury imposed $12 million in punitive damages against James Alex Fields, a self-professed neo-Nazi who drove a car into the Charlottesville crowd, killing Heather Heyer. He was convicted of murder and sentenced to life imprisonment for the most indelible moment of violence during the rally. The case represented the latest in a decades-long strategy of plaintiffs using civil lawsuits to hobble hate groups by attacking their financiers. It's unclear whether the Charlottesville defendants would be able to pay. The split verdict came one day after jurors sent a note to U.S. District Court Judge Norman Moon, saying they had been unable to reach unanimous decisions on the federal conspiracy claim. The judge thanked the jurors for their service on Tuesday and assured them that a courtroom sketch artist's drawing of the verdict's delivery would not show their faces or other identifying characteristics. This case has sent a clear message. Violent hate won't go unanswered. There will be accountability, said Amy Spitalnik, executive director of Integrity First for America, which organized the lawsuit. The nine plaintiffs still intend to get a verdict under federal conspiracy claim by refiling the case, said Roberta Kaplan, one of the attorneys who represented the group. No one will ever bring violence on the streets of Charlottesville, Virginia, ever again, because they know what will happen if they do, Roberta Kaplan said. Richard Spencer, a former leader of the white supremacist and white nationalist movement, called the alt-right, did not respond to a message seeking comment on the outcome of the trial, in which he represented himself. The case focused on 2 days in August, 4 years ago, 2017, when hundreds of white supremacists descended on Charlottesville, Virginia. They marched with lit tiki torches and chanted, "Jews will not replace us." Fights broke out between white supremacists and counter-protesters. The groundbreaking lawsuit was filed shortly after the rally by Charlottesville residents who said they had been injured in the violence. The plaintiffs included a minister and a number of students. Several defendants are leaders of the extremist right, including Christopher Cantwell, a neo-Nazi podcaster who is serving a prison sentence for extortion. White nationalist Jason Kessler, the Charlottesville rally's chief organizer, and Nathan D'Amigo, a white supremacist who founded the group Identity Europa. Attorneys for the plaintiffs argued that evidence showed the defendants planned the rally knowing violence would ensue. The defendants, 24 individuals and organizations, acknowledged espousing racist and anti-Semitic views, but denied they had conspired. Plaintiffs brought the case to trial under the federal Ku Klux Klan Act, a Reconstruction-era statute that allows individuals to sue when violent conspiracies deprive them of their constitutional rights. The law was enacted after Klan violence prevented newly freed slaves from exercising their rights as full citizens. The plaintiffs had to prove not only that their injuries resulted from the United Right rally, but that the defendants had been involved in a conspiracy to commit racially motivated violence that caused those injuries. In an effort to do so, they relied on a trove of evidence, including hundreds of text messages among the defendants and hundreds of thousands of leaked communications from Discord, a messaging platform that many of the organizers of the rally in Charlottesville used leading up to the event. Throughout the trial, the defendants remained unapologetic about their racist beliefs. Some used the courtroom as a stage to praise Nazi leader Adolf Hitler or mock the Holocaust. During the closing arguments in the courtroom, a lawyer for the defense played a neo-Nazi recruitment video. The defendants sought to disassociate themselves from the central planning of the event and argued that they never intended for the rally to get violent. In his instructions to jurors about the conspiracy claim, District Judge Moon said they must agree only that a preponderance of evidence showed there was a mutual understanding, either spoken or unspoken, between the conspirators to commit at least one unlawful act. Spencer expressed regret for the events and for Heather Heyer's death. He and Cantwell tried to cast the trial as a referendum on First Amendment rights. District Judge Moon, who presided over the trial over more than 3 weeks, cut off those arguments and admonished the defendants to stick to the facts of the case. Lawyers for the plaintiffs produced evidence designed to show that the defendants conspired in planning the rally, knew it would descend into violence, and celebrated when it did descend into violence. The attorneys showed videos of the defendants discussing how well the rally went. Other evidence included communications and social media posts from the defendants talking about what equipment they would bring to Charlottesville and signaling they might hurt anyone who showed up to oppose them. "We are raising an army, my liege, for free speech, but for the cracking of skulls if it comes to it," read one of the text messages between co-defendants Kessler and Spencer. Plaintiff's attorney, Michael Block, noted a Facebook post in which Cantwell wrote, "If you think the alt-right is insignificant, you might want to ask the communist filth we send to the morgue and hospitals how insignificant we are." During cross-examination, attorney Michael Block asked Cantwell, "When you said the communists we sent to the morgue, you meant Heather Heyer?" "Yes," Cantwell replied. Lawsuit follows a successful decades-long tradition of using civil courts to decimate white supremacists and hate groups. Spencer said before the trial that the case had been financially crippling. In the 1980s and 1990s, the Southern Poverty Law Center used several chapters of the Ku Klux Klan on behalf of plaintiffs who had been intimidated or threatened. The lawsuits caused those chapters to file for bankruptcy or to shut down. The plaintiffs previously won default judgments against 7 of the 24 defendants. The plaintiffs' lawyers moved to enter those judgments formally after Tuesday, 23rd of November's split verdict was announced. The court has issued five-figured fines against 3 other defendants for failing to produce evidence or show up for court hearings or depositions, court files have shown.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of internet.
The Spotlight.
The December 2021 summit to focus on challenges and opportunities facing democracies, a summit called by the U.S. question, what gives the U.S. the lead to call for a summit on democracy, especially one that has political objectives? That is one of the controversies of this summit, along with how certain countries have been excluded and included in the summit. As a result, many have accused the U.S. of using the notion of democracy as a political tool to pressure other countries. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at whether the U.S. is even in a position to talk about democracy, let alone have a summit with that theme.
The United States has always touted itself as a leading democracy in the world. In line with such a narrative, the U.S. is scheduled to hold a so-called summit on democracy next month. But the names of some of the participants and absentees cast doubt on the motive behind such an event. The inclusion of Taiwan, and not China, poses not only a challenge to Washington, but exposes its real intention.
The U.S. action to push forward the group politics and provoke allied confrontations under the cover of democracy is a reproduction of the Cold War mentality, which is widely questioned and opposed by the wise persons in the international community.
Russia, which has also been excluded from the summit, said the meeting is aimed at creating divisions among countries and privatizing the term democracy.
They wish to privatize the very word democracy. In their opinion, democracy is only what corresponds to Washington's understanding of democracy. Obviously, this cannot be so and must not be so. And in fact, it is not.
Another challenge the U.S. faces is its decision to include Israel in the list of over 100 invitees to the virtual gathering. It has put a big question mark to the democratic nature of the event, given the Israeli regime's atrocities and crimes against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip on a daily basis. The administration of President Joe Biden claims the summit seeks to help stop democratic backsliding and erosion of rights and freedoms worldwide. Nonetheless, earlier this week, the Stockholm-based International Institute for Democracy and Electoral Assistance said it is the first time that the U.S. has been added to its list titled Backsliding Democracies. The international think tank also pointed to a, quote, decline in the quality of freedom of association and assembly in the U.S. during the summer 2020 protests after the police killing of George Floyd. Floyd's death once again turned the spotlight on racial bias toward African Americans and other minority groups in the U.S. The support for the Saudi-led war on Yemen and huge arms sales to the kingdom also put a question mark on U.S. claims to be a leading human rights advocate. The U.S. military adventurism has also exposed its real face. Invasions of Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, and some other countries under different pretexts, including fighting terrorism and bringing democracy, have only resulted in the loss of lives of hundreds of thousands of innocent civilians. Sanctions are yet another tool the United States has used for decades against others, including Iran and Venezuela. But the economic warfare has brought suffering to the people in these countries, as they are unable to access the basic humanitarian needs such as food and medicines, leading to the death of many innocent people. Given the humanitarian impacts of U.S. policies and its long-standing support for undemocratic regimes, it remains to be seen how Washington wants to protect democracy in the format of its planned summit.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Spotlight, we have the human rights defender and the national organizer for Black Alliance for Peace, Ashamu Baraka, who joins us from New York. Also joining us, columnist and author Patrick Lawrence, who joins us from Norfolk, Connecticut.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, like to welcome you both. And I'm going to start with you, Ajay Mubaraka, and just get your reaction, generally speaking, on a summit with the term democracy used as a theme, as announced by the U.S.
Well, clearly, no one who is serious will as a serious attempt to address the challenges of democracy and the aspiration toward democracy globally at this historical moment. Clearly, the U.S. does not have the moral or political authority to take the lead in of that sort. So it's clear that it is primarily an attempt to weaponize the ideal of democracy, to suggest that democratic practices should only reflect the kind of limited democratic practice we see in the United States, and to use it as a weapon against their political foes. So it's not a serious attempt. It's a propaganda ploy, and it's quite clear that most people around the world see it in those terms.
Patrick Lawrence, doesn't the fact that the White House decision to invite a number of countries and exclude others mean that that's an undemocratic choice to begin with?
Look, I don't think this, to be honest, I'm rather surprised they're going through with this when they announced their intention to hold a summit on democracy. I think it was last spring. My own thought was they wouldn't dare. But they're doing it, and I'm with Ajamo on a number of his points. This is really not about democracy. That word has been hollowed out very regrettably. This is about empire. This is about those nations who are loyal to the empire, and about those who are not, and they are to be excluded, of course. We've just had elections in Nicaragua, and we've just had elections in Venezuela, to take two ready-to-hand examples. Those two nations aren't there. As you pointed out, Israel is. It's simply not to be taken seriously. And I think probably a number of those countries that are there, I'm thinking of some of the West Europeans, are there because it is time to humor the stumbling giant. I think that defines the conduct. In many cases, that defines the conduct of traditional American allies.
Well, we had back in February, Ajamo Baraka, when the now current U.S. President Joe Biden said that he wants the U.S. to return to the global leadership status that it had, and to basically look at what he called authoritarian leadership, or forces, I should say, and he named China and Russia. But that came fresh off the heels of what we saw, an election in which the former President Trump called it a sham and called it to have been stolen, on top of all the other crises that the U.S. was going through that broke and shattered, really, the notion of democracy. So doesn't that smack of double standards when it comes to how the U.S., for example, uses the word democracy?
Well, of course it does. But they're not really concerned about that as long as they are assured that their propaganda messages would be communicated through the corporate media to their intended target. And their intended target isn't necessarily a global opinion, but in fact, domestic opinion, to perpetuate the fraud that the U.S. is in fact committed to democracy and even committed to human rights, and that the Biden administration has the authority to champion these terms. So this is double standard. It's outrageous. Patrick just commented on the fact that we had two elections, one in Nicaragua and one in Venezuela, and it's important to note that in both of those experiences, the states that attempted to interfere directly in those democratic processes were, in fact, the states that pretend to be the champions of democracy and self-determination, the U.S. and their European allies. So again, we can't take this seriously. If they were serious about democracy then, and the so-called authoritarian governments, let's push for
for elections in Saudi Arabia. Let's see if we can have a free and open election in Honduras. So this is pure propaganda. It is only in place to perpetuate the fraud that Europe and the U.S. Have the ability to impose their will on everyone else with some degree of moral authority. And we, I think the people of the world are saying, no, this fraud has to end at this point.
So a point that's made there, Patrick Lawrence, from our guest, Ajamu, is, for example, how the U.S. supports Saudi Arabia that doesn't have elections. So doesn't that spell, again, a double standard when it comes to how the U.S. supports the notion of democracy, and yet it supports regimes, dictatorial ones, like Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, you know, look, double standard is a fixed characteristic of American foreign policy. I don't think we need to go very long on that point, okay? What we have here with this new word, popular word in Washington, authoritarians, right? It's just a substitute for the word communism during the Cold War, right? They use this word to make distinctions that serve the imperial purpose. That's what's going on here. The Saudis, I assume they're not there, but they're just quietly put to the side. It doesn't change the American alliance with the Saudis. That's not going to change until the Saudis run out of oil. Double standard. My only point here is we need not go long on it. It's just a given of American conduct and has been for many decades.
Well, let's get some reactions here from what two of the vocal critics of this have been, one Russia, the other China. Russia, and this question goes to you, Ajay Mubarak, has said Joe Biden aims to divide countries. Russia was not included in that list. And it furthermore went on to say, quote, the U.S. prefers to create new dividing lines, dividing countries into those that are, in their opinion, good and those that are bad. That came from Dmitry Peskov, the Kremlin spokesperson. Do you think that, do you agree with what Russia has said, that Washington is trying to divide countries, and what they furthermore said to privatize the term democracy?
My only disagreement with that comment is that instead of the term privatizing democracy, what the U.S. is attempting to do is to colonize the term democracy. Look, there are lines of demarcation here, but the question becomes, who sets those lines? Let's say that a definition of a commitment to democracy are those nations that adhere to international law, that don't operate as rogue states, that don't attempt to bring about so-called regime change in other people's national environments. If we had that kind of definition of a commitment to democracy, then of course the U.S. and most of the United States would not be participants. So this is all, again, a continuation of an ideological assault and affront to, in fact, make divisions and to escalate international tensions.
Well, none of this maybe would really matter that much, Patrick Lawrence, if the U.S. did not weaponize its approach to democracy and other countries. And by that, we can talk of a couple examples. One is the use of sanctions, and the other is the outright regime change approaches that the U.S. has had towards a number of countries. You talk about Venezuela, for example. So then this has to be taken seriously. How do you think this can be countered when the U.S. goes and has destructive instruments that is using, such as sanctions, in order to exert its notion of democracy on other countries?
I think, to begin, I think it might be useful to cast this whole summit as an instrument of Cold War II. I'm perfectly comfortable with the term. This is, as the Russians point out, as Ajamu has just said, the intent here is to divide the world. We need to see this in the context of Cold War II. That's my first point. How to counter this? I think in many ways that's up to local populations, the Iranians not least, and I think very important, of course, Ajamu will confirm this, you never ever read about this in the Western press, the mainstream press, but the non-West is coalescing in its own interest in recognition that West and non-West are in many very regrettable ways counterposed at this point. I think that's also very important. The Islamic Republic is trading oil and what have you with Venezuelans. They've got an oil convoy going to Syria. Iranian relations with China developing rather rapidly. Ditto Russia, as far as I know. Etc. This is extremely important, and I urge those listeners and viewers who may be American or British or generally West European not to underestimate what is going on in the non-West simply because it's unreported.
Well, we have talked about at least some instances of how democracy is not something that's working in the U.S. Ajmal Baraka, we recently had news of a U.N. expert that visited the U.S. The headline read, the U.N. expert decries near tyranny in U.S. against minority voting rights, in which it said that it said that electoral laws in some parts of the U.S., and it mentioned Texas as an example, is undermining democracy. And it does that by depriving millions of Americans, citizens, who belong to minority groups of the equal right to vote. Is that the case in the U.S.? And in a bigger picture, if these types of broken democracy instances are happening in the U.S., do authorities acknowledge it and then want to do something about it?
Look, the issue with so-called democracy in the U.S. is around the question of In 2014, a very important study came out from two researchers from Northwestern University and Princeton that concluded that instead of a democracy, what we have in the U.S. is an oligarchy. And they provided empirical data to back that up. So what we have with these processes that we refer to as democracy in the U.S. is just that procedural democracy, where basically is that a question of whether or not you can participate and make a choice, but who determines what you in fact can choose. And what we find with the U.S. is that the choices are very limited, that there are only two parties, those two parties, the duopoly, they work very hard, else can participate. You have election laws being passed across the country, making it more difficult for people to participating, in particular people from minority groups. This is the reality of the U.S., and yet U.S. officials then pretend that their process, their so-called democracy, is in fact the model, and that they have the moral right to impose their ideas of democracy on everyone else. It's absolutely incredible and really kind of obscene.
So in the general view around the world then, you think that when you see instances of democracy being broken in the U.S., Patrick Lawrence, as we have mentioned some instances, does that then have countries line up with each other and not really heed the policies or the directives that the U.S. has as we're seeing the world get more divided and why it is that the U.S. doesn't take care of its own house, put that in order before it goes out to the rest of the world and preach democracy?
Yeah, I think the good news here is that the rest of the world is opening its eyes to the nature of the American polity and the nature of American policy overseas. Let's not underestimate here. This is a new turn in my view. And a very important one. Repeat your question again, please, and I'll finish up.
What I'm trying to figure out here through this question is whether countries are realizing that, you know, the U.S. is a broken system when it comes to democracy.
Right.
So they're siding with each other, and therefore the U.S. is slowly, as you said, is in regress. So it doesn't have the clout on the world stage that it used to.
We are watching the multipolar world. Numerous of us have anticipated for many years. We are watching the multipolar world take shape. No question of that, right? And I think it's again, it's something you'll never read about in the American papers, but very, very important. You know, I mentioned this in my previous reply concerning what is going on in response to sanctions and so forth, right? Look, I want to make one other point. The basic the basic documents that this country was founded upon, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, I have problems with that, but we'll keep it in, and the Bill of Rights, the three of them, are very honorable, important documents, advances for all of humanity. Ho Chi Minh read Jefferson and the Declaration, right? This sort of thing. But American politics has that people need to understand the Republican ethos in America has basically been a veneer. This is my recent conclusion. Covering up an absolute greed fest for most of the history of this country. Politics now are no messier than they were in the 19th century. And so the question, the reality is we've never really lived up to our ideals. And the rest of the world is now waking up to this. And as multipolarity becomes a reality, the world's automatic gaze toward America after 1945, it's just done. In this way, the Summit on Democracy, I'm here to tell you, is basically a nostalgia piece.
Okay, thank you. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. Let me thank our guests. We have the human rights defender and the national organizer for Black Alliance for Peace, Ajamu Baraka from New York. Thank you for your comments. And also columnist and author Patrick Lawrence there from Norfolk, Connecticut.
With
that, we come to an end to this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks for tuning in. From Mikko Vitale, the entire team, it's goodbye. Until next time.